Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is poet, essayist, editor, teacher, and radio host Brian Blanchfield. Blanchfield is the author of the two poetry collections, Not Even Then and A Several World. A Several World won the 2014 James Laughlin Award from the Academy of American Poets, as well as being longlisted for the National Book Award in Poetry. Blanchfield's writing has appeared in Harper's, The Nation, The Paris Review, Conjunctions, Guernica, and Story Quarterly, among others. And since 2010, he's been the poetry editor at Fence magazine, and since last fall has been the Penn Poetry Series guest editor. Blanchfield also teaches poetry and nonfiction at the University of Arizona and produces and hosts the poetry and music show Speedway and Swan on KXCI in Tucson. He's here today on Between the Covers to talk about his third book entitled Proxies, Essays Near Knowing, a book he describes as part cultural close reading, part dicey autobiography. Eileen Miles calls it a sexy book. Wayne Kostenbaum says its sentences are modern marvels. Claudia Rankin calls Proxies interrogative, unsettling, and brilliant. And Maggie Nelson says Proxies raises the bar on what is possible in the realm of creative nonfiction, that she knows no book like it, nor any recent books as thoroughly good in art or in heart. Welcome to Between the Covers, Brian Blanchfield.
Thank you, David. It's great to be here.
So I think Maggie Nelson is right that this book sets its own terms. It's its own singular universe. And part of that, I think, is because you actually literally set some terms, some constraints for Proxies. So I'd love to talk about your two constraints to start out the show. The first one is you decided to write the essays without any ability. You constrain yourself without access to any authoritative texts, without access to the internet or to books that you might refer to. How did you arrive at this constraint, and what do you see as the purpose of it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a total suppression of access to outside authority, to secondary sources, to authoritative sources. And I guess that there's a kind of non-academic sort of oomph behind that, a kind of faith that there is intellection in essaying outside of academia. How I arrived at it was really kind of by chance. I mean, I'm a poet mostly, and before the last year or two, exclusively a poet. And I was having a difficult time finishing the poems in my second book, A Several World. And I really started this project as a kind of prompt into language in the morning, to have the internet off and to write what I knew or estimated or remembered or misremembered about one topic at a time. There's a real miscellany in this book, as you know. I mean, there's some of the early essays back then, so this would have been 2009, 2010, were on Brer Rabbit, on sardines, the hiding game, on owls, that was the very first one, on containment, on different topics, on foot washing. And I think that there was another urge that I was beginning to feel, which is in my mid-30s, going into my late 30s then, I also sort of wanted to say what I knew, which is, I don't know, something that was not available to me in the same way in poetry. And behind that urge was a kind of, I guess, a sort of psychological integrative urge. I wanted to say what I knew, not only as a, quote, and you can't see on the radio, air quotes, queer intellectual poet, but also as the son of a truck driver and a primitive Baptist from central Piedmont, North Carolina, as someone who, as a professor, has been on the margins of and absorbed by and expelled by academia over the years. I wanted to say what I knew in a number of different subject positions, which many people or some readers might perceive as unlikely subject positions. And I wanted I guess there was a kind of integrative urge that people have often in midlife. So, it could well be this is a sort of version of an early midlife crisis. I prefer the term reckoning. It seemed like a kind of a moment for reckoning.
And what do you see you have rolling endnotes at the end called mm-hmm. corrections, where mm-hmm. you literally correct some of the errors of memory or other errors of potentially misperception.
Yeah.
How do you see that those rolling endnotes in relationship to this desire to tell what you know?
Yeah, that's been maybe the most fun part of this book. It's called Correction. It's a 21 or 22 page rolling endnote, as you say, in which fact after fact, and as briefly as possible, with some permission for some style within it, I redress the errors that I make along the way on my own authority. I get a lot of things wrong, and also suppose a lot and speculate a lot. And so fact after fact at the end, whether it's about, you know, what Donald Winnicott actually said about tickling, or what the actual use of the foyer was originally, or how Roland Barthes died, struck by a laundry van in 1980, while he was giving his last seminar in Paris. Fact after fact, Juice Newton did not sing the song Tumbleweed. Sylvia did instead.
Right.
So there's a kind of jumble and sort of miscellany toward the, you know, in that last piece, which in a way is the 25th essay in this book, and is also kind of also sort of an index for the miscellany that I am. There's a piece of me that the graduate of my Primitive Baptist faith as a kid who appreciates pushing against what happens after the reckoning. So there's a kind of afterlife of facts is how I like to think of it at the end, where nothing is wrong, and yet there's a kind of, there's an indexical relationship to me. There's a little biography after the autobiography.
I like that way of putting it.
Yeah, thanks.
And there's a second interesting counterpoint, a second constraint that you set for yourself in proxies also to stay with the subject at hand, mm-hmm. and tell me if I'm phrasing this wrong, but stay with the subject at hand until you feel unsettled in some way, till you get to a place of dynamic vulnerability, perhaps.
Thanks. Yeah, that's right. The second constraint occurred to me soon after the first one. In fact, I think in a way it's a byproduct of the first one. I'm interested in continuing to think about how they're related, but yeah, the topic, whatever it happened to be, frottage, the sex act, dossiers, abstraction, confoundedness, the leave and billiards, I chose knowing that there was some hot material in it for me, that somewhere within there I would discover a kind of personally vulnerable terrain and the prompt or the invitation to myself was to stand there and kind of continue to unpack from there.
You've said in an interview before that Baudelaire's definition of beauty was misfortune exteriorized. Mm. And I wondered about that in relation to the second constraint, whether maybe the destination was that sort of beauty of personal vulnerability.
Yeah. Wow, that's really interesting. It makes me think of something my therapist said. She's Italian by birth and has Greek heritage, and she she quoted for me her English translation of her favorite Italian translation of the Odyssey, in which at the end Odysseus returns, I think she says, splendid with something and failure. There's something about being splendid with, I'm botching that quote, which is really lovely, but misfortune exteriorized as though you could visually apprehend where someone has been and what's befallen them is interesting to me in relationship to these essays.
I also pictured you have these titles on sardines on house sitting, mm-hmm. but you have the same subtitle for everyone.
Yeah.
Permitting shame, error, and guilt, myself, the single source. I imagined you sitting at a computer with mm-hmm. that phrase like taped across the top. Is that?
Yeah. The very first one of these I wrote, I was in the Los Feliz Public Library in Los Angeles, and my boyfriend and I had an argument, and I didn't storm off, but I went off for the day. I had very little money. I was using his old laptop, which I think even had a sort of dial-up sort of internet connection, and I went to the Los Feliz Library, and there wasn't Wi-Fi there anyway, and so I sat in a hard carrel and you know, was in a writing mood. And that's what I did. I kind of put the topic at the top of the page and then came up with some version of this subtitle, which I didn't know was a subtitle, but would be kind of a banner, a prompt, permitting shame, error, and guilt, myself, the single source. And permitting was kind of a key word in that to explore something with a permission to myself. To explore what was sensitive within that to me.
Yeah. In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Brian Branchfield about his essay collection, Proxies, Essays Near Knowing. Is there a conversation going on with any predecessors or influences in the essay world? The ones that I thought of mm-hmm. were mostly signified by the repetition of title. For instance, Francis Bacon or Montaigne's mm-hmm. essays all have a similar form, like of this or of that.
Or
and here we
that.
Have on this mm-hmm. or on
right.
that. Mm-hmm. Are there any that you are, that you feel like some of these constraints come from, or do you feel like they truly just arose out of your own personal experience?
No. There's for sure. I mean, there was something that felt very original to that that time for me in this project, but no, there's several traditions I think that I'm borrowing from. One for sure is Montaigne's, and even I would say among writers, you know, in the 250 years or so around his lifespan, Sir Thomas Browne, also, mm-hmm. in a kind of something about. Brown's kind of fussy, corrective essaying in what's it called? Inquiries into Vulgar and Common Errors.
Oh, that's
pseudodoxia,
a great title.
Or Pseudodoxia Epidemica, which is a wonderful book, really stylized, in which he's, you know, disabusing dear reader of a false notion that, for instance, pelicans feed their brood by nibbling, the mother pelican nibbling from her own breast and feeding the blood to the young. He disabuses that and writes little essayettes about what's true instead and how the error has come to be. How the false knowledge has come to be. He's just one of the best stylists in English. But then also equally kind of empirical or empiricist. I never know which of the two words to choose. And I know they have different meanings. But another writer like Montaigne and to some extent Brown around that era is Gilbert White, the sort of first naturalist, mm-hmm. Gilbert White of Selborne. All of them writing from not research, but rather attention to the thing. Expert in Montaigne's case, friendship or Virgil or what have you, by being present to and thinking through the topic. You know, I think that was true for those skeptic writers, those early essayists. So that's for sure one tradition, the oldest tradition. But there are others, you know, that are equally important to me, if not more important, including a kind of a semiotic cultural studies tradition that for me kind of begins with Roland Barthes' Mythologies and Empire of the Signs, and sort of reads one text after another, unpacking how it means and how it functions in culture, and plenty of scions in his tradition now are some of my favorite writers. Hmm. Wayne Kestenbaum, Chris Krauss, wonderful art writer and novelist, Maggie Nelson, I think, is in that tradition as well and expanding it significantly. Hilton Alls, I think, mm-hmm. White Girls and the Women, a number of Adam Phillips to circle back to writers who use that preposition on kissing, tickling, and being bored is one of my favorite books. And so is Allison.
That's a good title.
It's great. It's such he's one of those writers who, you know, you could choose Lauren Isley or other writers who have a discipline, a science, but who are just ingenious writers and their expertise has little to do with their research expertise. It's really about attending to the thing at hand and thinking through it.
Well, let's have our listeners hear one of the essays we had discussed on containment. Maybe you can just do a brief introduction of what led you to write on containment.
Oh, sure. Okay.
If you want to, or we can just hear it without it.
Yeah, maybe I won't say anything about it beforehand.
Okay, great.
Except that what I've learned that I like to do, I don't know if it's useful or not, is to read from the relevant portions of correction first. So okay. I'll read the
So these are things that later on you realized were errors of sorts.
That's right. These are corrections of errors that occur in that essay. So this is from the correction. The risk in tickling past the point of pleasure is, for Adam Phillips, the child's hysteria, humiliation, and intensely anguished confusion. He makes no extrapolation from the experience of disarray in being tickled to other corollary fears of uncontainability. But from a comparative study of phobias, he derives a kind of two-degree structure of fear in First Hates, a later essay in On Tickling, Kissing, and Being Bored. The tickling narrative, unlike the sex narrative, has no climax. The term proprioception, likewise the term interoception, was coined by English neurophysiologist Charles Scott Sherrington in 1905. Lear, what, so young and so untender? Cordelia, so young, my lord, and true. Lear, let it be so, thy truth then be thy dower. Here I disclaim all my paternal care, propinquity, and property of blood, and as a stranger to my heart and me, hold thee from this forever. On containment, permitting shame, error, and guilt, myself the single source. A few things became clear in the moments and months after I was attacked by a dog at age 9. Within months, it was clear that my consequent fear of dogs had engaged a far greater fear. Within moments, it was clear that the dog, our dog, Sam, was my father's dog, loyal to him foremost. Sam, a mature, blue-black, purebred chow, rushed to the door one evening just as I did to meet my father, who had been away a while. My mother was in the kitchen. We had just moved back to Charlotte from Paris, Tennessee, undoing the relocation we had all made when he left Roadway to work for Transcon 9 months earlier. He was sort of at large still, out on days-long interstate truck runs and still stationed in Tennessee without us, orchestrating the sale of the life that never quite took. The tractor-trailer he parked outside shook the Charlotte house a bit. At the back door, his dog and his son had both come to welcome him, and when he appeared there, Sam turned to his rival in the tight space of the mudroom and in a single motion, prefaced by a low growl, seized and ripped the flesh off the right side of my face, cheek to jawbone, so that in the stunned minutes thereafter, both of my parents would later say they could see my clenched back teeth when my mouth was closed. Sam was banished instantly to the back lot, or retreated there, ashamed, confused, and swiftly we made preparations to ride to the emergency room. Despite spilling blood and saliva where my face had been, I was numb to the pain, doing as I was instructed, completely mobile, cooperative with the towels, functioning in shock. On my father's lap, so rarely availed to me, in the passenger seat, as my mother drove, I was prevented from flipping the visor down to see the damage in the mirror, but repeated often that one desire, to see for myself what was clearly disturbing my parents, neither of them even 30 years old, it now occurs to me, the year they divorced. What was the damage was the question, yes, but also, what does it look like inside me? I could hardly contain myself. A plastic surgeon was airlifted in, and that night I had reconstructive surgery and came away sewn up with many stitches inside and outside my mouth. A phenomenal operation, everyone said. It was 1982, and with insurance then, I suppose a secretary and a truck driver could afford it. I was swollen and in bandages for weeks, a pathetic, dopey monster at school for a while, and then the wound became scar, and for the next 8 years tightened and traveled from my cheek to my chin as I grew into the face I have. There were a lot of nerve endings gathered in it, and it drives me a little crazy, distributes a sort of unsettling, illocable energy within when a lover plays with that part of my face. I feel the same about my navel. It's my recollection that the Winnicottian psychologist and essayist Adam Phillips himself extrapolates broadly from his analysis of tickling. But if not, the generality I have found so insightful is mine. Beyond any fear is a greater circumambient fear, a terror, that one will be insufficiently able to hold that fear. That if the stimulus is present and ongoing, unchecked, one might fall apart, come to pieces, and her faculties disintegrate. In sustained tickling, we learned, there exists an outer lip or membrane between the simpler immediate excitement of fear and the shameful and complete loss of bodily control and mental composure. That sensible, pleasurable brim of containment is what makes tickling a good study for Winnicott's concept of holding, his determination that healthy child development needs a responsible, aware, caring adult good enough to hold, to stay with, and make room for, and validate, and check a child's pleasures and fears and emotions, and acknowledge even the most confounding of them in the child's independent trials and explorations as inbounds and worth expressing and worth celebrating in their human specificity. Without such a parent, if a parent has diminished capacity or is narcissistic or in trauma or private crisis or absent altogether, protective self-sanctity is a greater necessity sooner, and the child's retention of control, for instance, can be acute and maladaptive and difficult to reverse. On into my 20s, I can remember struggling to destroy a kind of metaphysical conviction that disclosure was the enemy of integrity. Proprioception, the term Charles Olson made famous for poetry, is the sense of the body's orientation and balance and weighted proportion of its parts. Knowing I face forward is proprioceptive. Interoception is the sense one has of what is inside him. If I have pain in my urethra from dehydration, or if my heart skips a beat, it is interoceptive sensitivity that detects it. A friend of mine who recently confided to me that he's tested HIV positive described how he knew the flu symptoms he had in November were more than the flu. He knew something was different inside. He said he even knew the moment, weeks after contracting the virus, he seroconverted. He described this interoceptive sense as body consciousness, but couldn't say where he felt it. He didn't need to make himself understood. Likewise, where is fear or desire or grief if not inside? I know it is within because I contain it. My enabling delusion as a child, essentially, was that affective experience was like a pain in the gut or a lump in the throat. It was something inside yourself that you could choose to hold in. In Charlotte, we shared the neighborhood with a number of large, ferocious dogs. This was true before the bite, and I was wary of them then, but afterward, in my presence, it was as though they were lit up with bloodlust and rage. In particular, there were a pair of German shepherds and a Doberman pincher along my walk to the bus stop, and each morning seemed to be the morning that one would finally vault the fencing that barely kept him in. Naturally, I was terrified of what could happen if any of them got to me, and their threat was utterly convincing. Walking in a group was worse because sauntering at pace with everyone and even keeping up conversation as we passed, I nonetheless set off the savagery of the animals around us, and it could not be denied. It could not be covered with my pretenses to normalcy. When they charged, it was obvious they were charging me. It was evident their nasty, murderous mania had an object, and I was it. Even today, I feel the need to point out that my performance was flawless. I know I betrayed no trepidation in my mien or manner. I was very good and well practiced at keeping it in. When an older boy said it aloud, and when I worked out what he meant, I felt my situation grow in dimension. He smells your fear. Early on, you have a secret. It is almost as though the secret is there before you. You are ever in relation to it. You are its container, and because, by definition, the one imperative is that you cannot share the secret, perhaps you develop the understanding that no one in your small world may be entrusted with the knowledge of what's inside you. You become, through and through, a holding environment for the secret. It is so intrinsic that you could not, at so young an age, begin to know how to explore it. How you feel is the secret. Or it is not untrue to say the secret is how you feel. Because when someone asks how you are feeling and you cannot say, you can see them try to access what's inside, and it troubles you enough to close tighter or cover more. Your little mastery over it you know to be a life or death matter. It is the end, the very edge of abyss over which you send yourself if the contents are accessed. Then, one day, you wake up to the new reality that walking the same earth you have lived on all these years, growing increasingly proficient as the keeper of your contents, is at least one creature endowed with a singular ability to sense something you are concealing for your life, a creature whose report is loud as a gun. It smells your fear. In its presence, I could not contain myself. Even then, starting then, with new dread, I felt myself. I couldn't have said by what extroversion, but I knew eventually I was coming out. What was that going to look like? At the end of King Lear, a mirror is brought to the face of good Cordelia to be consulted. Lear calls for it, disbelieving the worst. At the beginning of the play, when she tells him that she cannot be wholly devoted to him, that she'll need to divide her devotions in loving herself and her eventual mate as well as her father, the king, he replies that honesty alone will be her dowry then. Honesty is what she is left with, disinherited, a birthright for one entitled to nothing. At his own tragic end, after Cordelia is presented to Lear with the news of her death, the looking glass is brought, on his command, to her face, closer, to her mouth. There's a moment, a last viable moment, before the glass is withdrawn, having captured no vapor from what would have been her breath, that the mirror is called a stone. A repurposing happens. The mirror is not a depth into which to view the reflection of one's composed facade, but rather a surface on which to manifest what comes from within. There is only the one conclusive turn in the mortal story, I suppose. Before that one, because of that one, there are a number of opportunities, precisely when one is petrified, to break the glass.
You've been listening to Brian Blanchfield read from his essay collection, Proxies, Essays Near Knowing. I just love the strange journey you take us on that, and that and all of the essays. But the fact that we go from a dog attack to tickling to proprioception and poetry to HIV to fear of dogs and King Lear, it ranges widely for a essay on containment. If you think about
it's not very well contained,
but it feels like that is an interesting interplay between the title. But another thing that is interesting when you're reading the essays together is the way you feel the conversation across essay. I don't think that's all entirely because they share constraints or entirely because they have the same structure for a title and this in the identical subtitle. Mm-hmm. There's also the repetition of us getting little pieces of you, like something about your travails in trying to get a teaching position, mm-hmm. or in something around your poetry career or around queer identity or about your family. And every time we notice another little piece. It's interesting that when we come to a question like in containment, you have the two questions, what is the damage and what does it look like inside of me? Hmm. And when you arrive at those questions, having read other essays, those questions feel like they're not contained in On Containment. I can ask those questions about you around your teaching position, search for teaching positions, or around your queer identity in relationship to your parents. They feel like they, and then those questions then echo forward as we progress through the essay collection too.
That's great. That pleases me. You know, one of the things I feel like I was doing with this book was teaching myself narrative, teaching myself nonfiction narrative, and even kind of ethics of temporality in a book. So each of these essays retains the present tense of its own ambient situation when I wrote it. I guess that's true. In other words, for instance, my stepfather is alive in the essay on foot washing. And I don't go back later and revise that to anticipate that he will die in the course of this book. So in a way, one of the things that was sort of most moving to me in writing this book was, I guess, the experience of having the temporality of 3.5 or 4 years in which things happened to me. So I couldn't have predicted at the outset which 24 topics I would choose and especially where they would send me and what work there was within them for me to do. And, you know, it's so peculiar for the poet in me to be reading sometimes, giving a reading from this work and to say, by this point in the book, you know about this protagonist, me,
right.
That X has happened, or you need to know.
Is that the key to keeping the essays relatively chronological in terms of when you wrote them, to create that sense of a journey of a self?
I knew about halfway through that's the order in which I wrote them would be the order in the book, because it did feel, you know, and that begins to speak to this other tradition, a kind of French tradition or new narrative tradition. I mean, I think of writers like Hervé Guibert or, again, Chris Krause or Dodie Bellamy or Michel Larry or writers for whom kind of the diaristic is sort of subtending the book. I mean, we feel like we're turning the pages and turning days as they progress. Hmm. I mean, there are other traditions and other writers who do that, but those are the guys I think about.
Well, you mentioned that part of this was teaching yourself to write narrative, and it made me curious about what you see of yourself when you're writing poetry versus when you're writing narrative. I know there's probably not one answer, and it's probably different with any number of different enterprises. However, well, you have a poem, for instance, in your last collection, Man Roulette, and mm-hmm. then you have an essay on Man Roulette.
Yeah.
What is the sense of discovery that you would feel that might be different because of the form that is containing it?
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I think around this topic a good deal, and you'd think that I would have a fixed, certain answer to this by now, but I don't. But I love thinking about, for instance, the poem on Man Roulette. The poem is called Man Roulette, and the essay is called On Man Roulette. And I guess if I'm thinking about how both of those pieces move, it might get us nowhere, or it might discover something. So in the poem, it's sort of a four-part poem, which loosely has a kind of metaphor of occupying booths in some kind of fair. You know, in this booth there is room for one. Get in here and hold me up is a line from that poem. And so there's a kind of loose analogy, a kind of world-making around the experience, even the private experience for me of visiting or being on manroulette.com, which was a website sort of now defunct, although there are other copy sites, which it's a sort of speed dating site for men, to use a euphemism.
Yeah.
In which you're clicked past by any number of men wherever they are in the world, Milan or Guayaquil, Ecuador. I write about this a little bit in the essay. You all have the room you're in and the reality you're in, and then the fantasy that you share in the text box and in the image box, the streaming video. So the poem ends up making kind of a world outside of that that's guided by the dynamics of being on that site and dating for an evening on that site. And the essay is, as all these essays are, sort of definitive at the beginning. What is it? How does it function? And paying attention to it until it reveals for me something else, a secondary subject. And there are any number of essayists who do this. I mean, John McPhee is one, and Claudia Rankine is another. To use two extremes. So it really is kind of a classic essaying of looking at the thing until some greater, larger, containing secondarity reveals itself, and then to say, to be kind of naked and vulnerable in that arena. So there are two different processes and two different kinds of discovery.
Yeah,
you know, the poem is discovering the sort of rules of its own world as it goes, and creating that, and not being fixed about that until, you know, very close to the end of the composition process. And the essay is discovering what else is behind this this sign or this phenomenon for me.
Well, for saying that you hadn't thought about it, you did.
I was just thinking about it. Yeah,
yeah, that was pretty good. Speaking of all of this, you say in the introduction that the essays might correspond to what you might call a self, but that they're not the same thing, and that the book is braver than you are. What does that mean? Or tell us a little bit about that sentiment.
Yeah, I think that I wrote that in the little prefatory note to speak behind the title, Proxies, a little bit. That wasn't always the title of this book, and when I hit on it, there's something about it that clicked for me. I like the false neologism of it. I mean, proxies is a word with very specific meanings, and in 2016, highly specific meanings, in military meanings and in political spheres. But I kind of liked it as a kind of diminutive form of approximation, and even.
We also mentioned that proxy in science.
Yeah.
Has a different meaning
than
it does that in common usage.
That's right.
Has to do with an allowance for imprecision.
Exactly. Yeah, you study something that's more available to you rather than the subject that you actually want to get data from, because it can be a proxy for that harder to reach subject.
So is the book a proxy for this self, a Brian Blanchfield? And through the reckoning is braver than the living.
I think that's a sound
apothem
there. Yeah, no, that's right. So proxies are not only approximations of the thing, foot washing in the leave or the near term or the understory, but yeah, then also sort of these deputy sentries. That's how I kind of came to think about it. Who the author, me, sends out sort of ahead of myself to kind of explore areas that I might not otherwise explore. And the braver than me part is just that. I mean, honestly, dispositionally, I'm a circumspect, furtive, shy person. And these essays are, especially some of them, are revealing and candid, even kind of radically candid about sex and sexuality, about, for instance, hiring practices and academia.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about that, about and revelation, because there were two journeys that we go on in Proxies that felt, I don't know if I can articulate why they felt linked, but I'm curious if they feel linked to you. Mm. One is that of becoming a writer and a teacher of writing, and the other is coming out. They feel linked, and then they're explicitly linked at one point. The first time you come out to a group of people is actually through reading a poem.
That's right.
To the group. So do they feel linked in some way to you? I mean, obviously they do because they're you, but otherwise, do they?
Does coming to be a writer and also a teacher of writing have a relationship to coming out and being openly gay? And
yeah, because you talk about not now and not yet, and in the contingencies of queer life,
yeah.
That also felt like it resonated with this tenuous life of a teacher of poetry in a corporate capitalist society,
and
the ways in which things are not on course in the same way that you would think in a heterosexual society and a corporate capitalist society. There felt like resonances in this book to me around both.
That's great. Yeah, you know, that essay that you're quoting from there on Frittage, which was excerpted in Harper's, about half of it published there, and the other half that wasn't published in the magazine, there's a fair amount of thinking about, so that essay is, like others, a kind of definitive essay about the sex act. It also then gets me to talk about being in New York in the late 90s and also growing up under the specter of HIV/AIDS, the sort of sex that some men and a fair number of women were having then. But then also about queer community, and that's the portion that you're talking about. I'm paraphrasing in that Jose Munoz's Cruising Utopia, which is a wonderful book, which he kind of lays out a theory of queer time, queer temporality, as being never instantiated in the here and now, but always not yet and not now. That's a poor paraphrase of what he says there. But there was something about that time and the way in which my generation in New York then was kind of psychosexually inscribed by, imprinted by the epidemic, that we were finding one another without much quote unquote queer tutelage. The generation older than us was traumatized and dying and not there in the same way that that things in which things might have passed down to us. So we were kind of figuring it out for ourselves, and that sort of community and that sort of perforce solidarity happened to be compatible with a kind of precariat economy, part-timing, contract work, adjunct work, and queerness belonged together at that time. And we, a number of writers and artists who were also teaching and doing editing or whatever, were building community around that and new sorts of structures of a family and community. Hmm. Yeah, so those two things are linked for me in the world. And I guess the dynamics of coming out and also and being a writer are linked. But that's a Maybe it's a longer kind of, that takes me longer to access.
I mean, I wasn't sure if I was,
only an hour
was
show.
Reaching for that or whether that was, was there. In
it's,
the text.
It's in there. Yeah.
Huh. I don't know if this was a taboo for you, but I'd imagine it's a taboo for some readers. The amount you very plainly expose, like how much you earn in a year in some of these jobs as a poetry teacher, or all of the horrible machinations around trying to get a teaching position in detail, in a way that feels a little electric and edgy.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I feel like of all the quote unquote transgressions in this book, that is the taboo that people feel and want to talk about. That essay on dossiers, which is the term for a file in academia on a candidate, how to make one, what's inside one, where does it go, who reads it, which committee members, which dean, what happens on a campus visit, and what happens in, for instance, an inside hire, et cetera. People have wanted to talk about that happily, and I think I think that essay has been a bit of a I don't know what to call it, a facilitator of conversation that kind of needed to happen. And so a number of writers who are on the market, and even a number of writers who are on the other side and in tenure track or tenured positions, have expressed, you know, gratitude and have wanted to say, you know, we all wanted to say that, or to name that name, or name that number, that salary. It's one of the, it's part of my life, and part of the project here was to be kind of disinhibited about shame.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of career shame that writers have, in terms around money. So yeah, I think that it was important to remain vulnerable in that territory too.
Yeah. In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today to Brian Blanchfield about his book Proxies, Essays Near Knowing a Reckoning. You have another essay. I think you can make the argument that a lot of these essays could be portals for understanding the wholeness, almost like they're, I don't know if you know Leibniz's monads, that each one contains the universe. So it's like the On Reset, that essay about the audition tape, where you watch a tape and everything's the same except for the main actor. It feels like that loops back to how you talk in the introduction about the proxies. In proxies, it changed as you changed, as we were talking about in chronology, but that the uniformity is what leads to the variation in a strange way. And there, it felt like On Reset was almost became a proxy for the whole project in
you're
a way.
You're such a good reader, David. This is great. You know, I even think that there was a moment, I'm remembering now, that On Reset was going to be the kind of introductory essay. I was going to keep it where it was late in the book, but it was still going to be like an essay about these essays.
About proxies.
And I decided, you know, not to do that. But I think in a way, the only thing that's, well, correction is in a way a poetic text, but otherwise, the only thing in this book that is poetry or poetic for me is the way in which the essays reset. There's a constraint which poets often use, and each of these 24 essays sort of resets and starts again, as though the one before it were a template and it was going to cycle through with its own new material and run through the machine again. And there's something in that operation that feels like that feels familiar to me as a poet, as the way a poet works. Stanza after stanza, or unit after unit, and that kind of and Reset ends up being the essay on Reset ends up being about how poetry works in a way too.
Well, I mean, for sure, you as a poet is evident in the syntax too. It's not just in those concerns. I mean, you can hear it in the language when you're reading on Containment. So I wanted to ask you about the idea of the leave in On the Leave.
Yes.
Maybe you could talk about what the leave is in games, and then also how it connects to narrative for you.
Sure. Yeah, so the leave in billiards, if you're shooting pool, is the arrangement of however many of the 15 balls are left on the table and in what position from the prior shot. That's the leave. You're given the leave from either the shot you've just shot and you've pocketed a ball, or from what your opponent has left you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it seems to suggest that you aren't only entitled to use them, but expected to use the leave, essentially.
Sure.
Yeah. Like, and then you have this interesting...
It's your given.
Right.
At the beginning of your shot, of your turn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's this interesting connection, I think, to that and the way you're using memory, or the limitation in proxies to only memory. If we think of the memory as the leave, essentially, of what you're going to, how you're going to play the game with what you're left with, you've eliminated the access other than what's on the table with you.
Right.
You say this thing in that essay, it can be very attractive in one's narrative to replace the given with the leave, because if I equate my foundational circumstances with leavings, the discard, the refuse, even the ruins of others, I feel more entitled to use them to build from that rubble. And that also feels like a nod to collaboration, that all work potentially is collaborative, if we're honest, in a sense, with, like, when we talk about influences, what is left that we're working with. And I wondered about that. I don't know.
We have our own sort of bibliography inside our head, right? That
I don't know if that's what you were saying in that specific quote, but you've done collaborative art making.
Yes.
Writing poems with other poets between dance and writing. And then the very structure of your radio show, you have a co-host every week.
Right.
You collaborate on what poems are read and the music that's played. Yeah. And half of the show is influenced by this other poet or writer.
And the poems and songs are sort of collaborating in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if you have a philosophy around collaboration, or I guess one question I would have for you is, do you think people who are drawn to constraints, as you seem to be, are more into collaborative art? And if so, why? And I ask also because I think of, like, say, in the Olipo movement, you have tons of, it's by definition constraint-based, and there seems to be a preponderance of collaborative art being made at the same time.
Yeah, interesting.
As a constraint itself, the collaboration.
Right. Well, people who use constraints are probably less interested in a kind of univocal, authoritative, subjective kind of writing. They're interested in having to obviate an obstacle and kind of trick themselves into the content of the poem or what have you, to enter into the back door that otherwise you would access politely up the front walk. You know, you get to the same place, but you've discovered in a different way what's there for you. So yeah, I mean, I think collaboration does the same thing. I mean, you've got this this active other agent whose reactions and responses give you your given often in your part. Yeah, the collaboration with dance comes to mind. A wonderful choreographer who now lives in San Diego, but I knew her in Missoula where I taught, Anya Cloud. She and I put together these all-day, six-hour integrative movement and writing workshops called From A to B and Back Again. I was B and she was A. And, you know, and poets like Leslie Scalapino, Sandra Alcosser, a number of writers have, Jackson McClough famously, have collaborated with dance. And Anya's movement exercises would give us the sort of content as writers, and the results of our prompted writings would motivate the next movement in the piece. And that was the best day of teaching, you know, in my life. It was like a day of adult play, for one thing.
Yeah.
But it also it kept discovering itself, and it was really exhilarating. And that was, if you have a collaborator that you really trust, it really is a process of discovery that you couldn't do on your own. You couldn't cultivate on your own.
You have a word in Proxies and also in your last poetry collection that I had to look up, elaity. Mm. And it seems to be related to reciprocity, if not collaboration. Could you talk about what elaity is?
Oh, boy.
You can, I don't want to put you on the spot, but...
Yeah, it's a word I like because it's a beautiful word. I guess it's so... it is, it means itness or he-ness. It's like the masculine pronoun in French, IL, a sort of the noun form of that. I believe, I'm going to look this up. Sorry.
I have it here, actually. I think it's at least what I looked up. It said, signifies the impossibility of initially pronouncing a vow in some kind of reciprocity with the other person.
Oh, interesting. I mean, I have the word from Emmanuel Levinas, and he meant by itness, by elaity, a kind of position of thirdness or even God.
Is this all at all related? You've said in multiple interviews that we is not the plural of I, and I wondered what you meant by that. I can mm-hmm. project myself into that and come up with my own meaning, but I wondered about that phrase for you.
I don't know if it's related, and I didn't say that phrase. Someone else, I don't know whom to quote, but I loved this little aphorism, which is true, grammatically, and also true ethically. So whenever you're speaking, especially in literature and in poetry in particular, there's a kind of obnoxious, unanimous we. We lost a really great poet last week. Oh, we did? Who are we? What do you mean? To move from the first person pronoun of direct experience to the we collective shouldn't ever be just multiplying yourself, you know, as though we many are copies of I.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if it's related. I think probably not. You know, when Levinas uses that term, he's often saying that, like in French, il y a, there is, and also in German, es gibt, it gives. Those are both ways to say there is, or there are. I mean, it's like, there is snow on the ground. Il y a neige. There's a way in which there's a kind of giver of those givens. And who is that? That's elaity. That's the God. That's whatever thirdness there is.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
So you derive it from the grammar.
If you're open to reading another piece,
I'd love to.
Let's have you do On Foot Washing, since it is about reciprocity in a way.
Sure, yeah. On Foot Washing, permitting shame, error, and guilt, myself the single source. Foot washing is a sacrament in Protestant orders that understand the Bible as the Word of God, including the old particular Baptists and the primitive Baptists, especially in the Piedmont and Appalachian regions from Pennsylvania to Georgia. In the primitive Baptist churches I grew up in, the ritual was part of an annual communion. After a short sermon or reading from Scripture, I think there's a story in which Christ humbles himself to wash the feet even of the apostles who would soon betray him and enjoins others to such humility. The members of the church would rise to sing hymns, called out by title or hymnal page number, and a procession would begin in an orderly fashion such that sister with sister and brother with brother, a pair would form and a wash basin would be chosen to fill with warm water. With two small white towels, the partners would sit on and kneel before the front pew and alternate soaping and rinsing the feet of the other. It was touching to watch an elder and a younger man exchange the service, lean and muscular, gnarly and horned. Maybe 10 basins were in use at a time, and everyone else kept up the singing while the pair worked silently. I sang the lyrics of Palms of Victory or Come Unto Me, watching every grimace and blush on my mother's face with her slender feet in the old woman's hands the last time. A 13-year-old knows his single mother's foot, an 8.5 narrow. Back when a naturalizer salesman would bring his shoehorn and ramp stool over to straddle his customer's fitting. To wash one's feet independent of the rest of the body, and even to wash the feet of others, was not an unusual act in the time and place Jesus Christ lived, in an economy of hospitality, Greek in origin. He and his friends wore sandals, of course, and customarily the feet were the most unclean part of anyone entering a home, particularly travelers. Was that the function of the first foyer, the anteroom? Odysseus, dressed as the beggar back at Ithaca, was recognized by the scar on his leg when the old nurse was cleaning his feet. A warm foot bath was a welcome, and for a friend to give one to a fellow friend was perhaps a tenderness. Reciprocity was at the heart of it. Not to return the favor was to upset a balance. It may well be that originally the shoe was on the other foot when an erstwhile guest held his former hosts upon repayment of a visit. Somewhere, Guy Davenport must have an annotated bibliography on the topic, tracking it homosocially through art and literature. In Greek drama, it was even more honorable to wash a horrible foot, a putrid foot. In Philoctetes, the ogre has been exiled on his island on account of a deception rooted in foot disgust. His fellow sailors led their wounded, festering compatriot ashore and sneaked back to the boat slip without him, unable any longer to abide the smell of his rank, diseased, accursed foot. But the play concerns a second deception in which a young honorable man is enlisted by Odysseus to gain Philoctetes' trust, to hear his laments and sympathize, to enter his cave and tolerate the stench, and then snatch the ogre's magic bow when he is seized again predictably by foot pain. Because the young man's sympathy is real, his guile is tested. Nonetheless, he executes the plan and procures the treasured bow for Odysseus in the wings. It is for Philoctetes as though the first betrayal was reopened. Whatever psychic detachment from his own extremity he had managed is annihilated. His relationship with his own living rot, we know then, will only grow more shameful. And Odysseus, elsewhere the revenant hero, Messiah incognito, is here a craven opportunist, whose villainy, equally, is detachment from shame. When my stepfather Frank, in a torrent of spite and fury, humiliates my mother in the company of family or friends, over dinner or in his own hospital room, as he does regularly, relentlessly, set off by her miscomprehension of something or an oversight he has discovered, the room is stunned, shaken. There is nothing like it. Mortification is arresting for everyone present. However nefarious or admirable his other dealings may have been, the great disgrace of his life will have been his terrorism of the one devoted to him. The lasting shame of mine was enduring it by detaching from it. I left when I was 17, 5 years into their marriage, and I visit as seldom as I feel I can. Frank has had, for 5 or 6 years now, a chronic wound on the sole of his right foot, a condition not uncommon to advanced type 2 diabetics like himself. Bones in his feet are gradually crumbling and splaying, and abrasions form, Charcot syndrome. Because of the related impaired circulation and complete localized nerve loss, there is no pain, but there is constant danger of necrosis and toxic shock. The wound on his soul has intermittently wept and cracked and granulated for years, but never closed, despite a number of stimulative water and pressure and debridement treatments, and its inability to heal is the single reason he has been prohibited the kidney transplant for which he arranged a donor long ago, but for which he would need to be infection-free during post-operative immunosuppression therapy. The aperture of his wound has varied from dime to half-dollar size, and I have seen it 3 or 4 inches deep. Even then, it was frightfully clean, like a throat. My mother cleans it. Every evening, after dinner, after the dishes. She has a kit, a kind of carpet bag, with gloves and sprays and brushes and ointments and individually wrapped antiseptic wipes. He lifts his heavy leg to the butcher block table in their kitchen, and her movements are quicker and rougher than you might imagine, though her concentration is intense. She wipes the gullet of it and the rim. She gets it to granulate. After 25 years of marriage, she knows this part of his body best. He hasn't ever really seen it. Often, during, feeling nothing, he watches television.
You've been listening to Brian Blanchfield read from Proxies. You, in a conversation with Eileen Miles, have a conversation about when to exit a poem. And she talks about how she likens it to going to a party and leaving at the first thought of leaving, not lingering to see whether you should still stay, but at the first even possibility that you might want to leave, that's when you leave a poem.
Yeah.
And that's when you leave a party.
And somebody just told me that was the Irish exit.
Is it?
Yeah, I don't know. But that's without goodbye.
I was wondering how you know when these essays are done. If you felt like there was a feeling or a place that you arrive at.
Yeah, for sure. It's not any sense of having comprehensively treated the topic. I don't think any of these essays are comprehensive examinations of their subject matter. I think it's a feel. I think each one is attuned to a different sort of finality or break at the end. This particular essay felt like it needed to end still in the narrative of that little episode and not recur to any of the material earlier. That would have lessened the impact, and it wouldn't have arrived in the same way for me.
She also talks about literary family making, and I'm just going to use that as an awkward segue to doing a plug for your radio show, because I'm super addicted to Speedway and Swan.
Thank you.
It feels like this great act of literary family making, both learning about a new poet that you co-host with, but then all of those poets, old and new, that you guys read on that show. It's incredible.
Thank you.
And I think everybody should listen to the show, Speedway and Swan.
Speedway and Swan. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, David. Yeah. I like thinking of it as a kind of ever expanding family. I give the guest co-host a kind of prompt to bring in 5 or 10 poems that matter to him or her, from any era, old or new, any style. And then I bring in things from the new shelves at the Poetry Center where I work at the University of Arizona. And then we drop in music in between.
Yeah. With some great weird songs like the Persuasion singing The Grateful Dead, or like Richard Thompson singing Britney Spears.
Oh, that's so good.
They're great. I mean, it might sound horrible to people, but they're pretty delightful.
Covers, both of those. Yeah. I'm kind of addicted to cover songs.
Yeah, I noticed that reoccurs.
Yeah.
Well, tell us what what's next for you. Mm-hmm. What can we expect from Brian Blanchfield on the horizon?
That's a good question.
And congratulations on your Whiting Award.
Thank you. Thank you. So that happened last week in New York, and for the next month or so, I'm reading around the country. And when I get back to Tucson in the summer, I'm gonna be writing again this summer. I feel far from it, tragically far.
Nonfiction or poetry?
Well, I have I have happily, I have grant for the next poetry project that I'm working on, which is loosely, tentatively, provisionally called Piedmont. I live in Tucson, which is the Tohono O'odham word for foot of the mountain, and I grew up in the central Piedmont. And there's this a project of poems that's kind of compelled by that very simple symmetry. So that's what I'm working on now. But for sure, nonfiction isn't done with me. The last essays in this book stretched to 10, 11, 12 pages, and it was an effort to kind of contain what I was learning about longer forms in essaying and in narrative. And I've been reading a lot of James Baldwin again, and I love the 40, 50, 60 page essay form. Mm. And that's something I'm interested in. And I won't say much yet about the subject matter, because it's still really provisional for me. But
yeah.
But those are the two next book projects I'm thinking about.
Well, it's great having you on the show.
David, it was wonderful. Yeah. I love the show, and this has been so much fun. Thank you.
We're talking today to poet and essayist Brian Blanchfield about his latest book, Proxies, Essays Near Knowing. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.